Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Tzadi Aleph, Amud Aleph, 9 lines down. Tana Rabbanan, Hachosemet Hapara V'dashba, person who muzzles an animal and then uses it to thresh, Loke Umishalem. He gets Malkot because he violated an Iser Lav, but he also has to pay Dalet Gabim Lepara. He pays 4 Kav to someone who used a Para, V'gimel Kabim Lechamor. So obviously here we're talking about a situation in which the animal belongs to a third party, not to this individual himself. He rented the animal, and then he muzzles the animal while it is working. So first of all, he gets malkot for violating the law of l'tachsom shor b'disho. In addition to that, he has to compensate the animal, or the owner of the animal, with food, or the equivalent of what it would have eaten in this case. In the Chachamim Mishaer, that he would have eaten Dalet Kabim Leparat, that's what he would have had, and Gimel Kabim Lechamor. Don't we have a principle that you cannot be held accountable or culpable for the same infraction in two different ways? That means that you can't both get Malkot and a death penalty. You can't have two, the Gemara calls it Kedei Rishato, which is the Gemara Makot says, Mipnei Risha Achat Ata Mechaivo. You can only obligate him, make him culpable for one penalty. Avalo Mishtei Rishayot. You can't do it for two penalties. Right? There's a similar concept in the legal system of double jeopardy. You can't be tried twice for the same crime. Over here, it's not exactly the same, but you can't be penalized for the same crime, even though you're deserving of two punishments. You can't get punished twice for the same crime. That's true by Loke Umeit, and it's also true by Loke Umishalem, that you can't both get Malkot and also have to compensate. So to hear, Amar Abaye, Amani, who's this? Rabbi Meir, this is authored by Rabbi Meir, Damar Loke Umishalem, that you can get Malkot and pay at the same time, meaning that you can have both these penalties apply to the individual. The truth is, and that's what Tosfot spends time on, is that Rabbi Meir never really says that. Rabbi Meir argues with the Chachamim with regards to Motzi Shemra. Because by Motzi Shemra, we find that the individual, it says, V'yisru oto, that they give him Malkot, but he also has a penalty that he has to pay to the father of the woman about whom he was Motzi, this Shemra. So there he is, Loke Umishalem. But as Tosfot points out, it's clear over there that Mishalem is different, because that's Loke Mishalem Knas. That is a fine. And he says the same thing by Edim Zomimim. Edim Zomimim get Malkot because of the fact that they violated an Easter Lav of lying in Beit Din. But they also have a punishment of Kashir Zamam Lasot, which is that whatever they were trying to do the other party. So there he says the same thing, that they are loke umishalem. But again there, we're talking about a knas. It's a fine. It's not a monetary remuneration or compensation. It's a fine that we place on him. So Tosfot says, how do we know that Rabbi Meir really believes loke umishalem? We know that he believes loke umishalem knas. Over here, our case is a classic case of mamon. Over here, you're compensating for the lost food that he could have consumed in this part. That's not a knas. That's real compensation. So how do we know that Rabbi Meir holds that? So he says in the end that Rabbi Meir only says it about Loke Mishalem by Knas. Aval, Rabbi Meir must say, Imkein tu lekali de dukme kedei rishato ela bemita umalkot. What happens in the end for Rabbi Meir is that kedei rishato, which I mentioned before, is the limud that says you can only be chayav once and not twice. Rishachat velo shtei rishayot. But that you have to apply to different scenarios. The Chachamim apply it both to Loke umishalem, as well as loke umeit. Rabbi Meir will only apply that to mita and malkot, because he can't apply it to loke umishalem, because then that would upend his position with regards to knas. Since he doesn't apply kedei rishato over there, that's why he would say loke umishalem is fine, because there's no reason to exclude it or preclude it. So the default would be that you'd be chayav for everything. Unless you have a specific pasuk indicating otherwise, which we have, is kedei rishato. If you apply that pasuk, it says only one punishment. Rabbi Meir cannot apply that to areas of loke mishalem because he has examples or situations in which he does say you're loke mishalem. Happens to you those cases are knas, but it still means that he does not apply it by those cases. Since he doesn't apply it, therefore he must believe that loke mishalem. That's why Tosfot says throughout Shas, the Gemara always assumes that Rabbi Meir is the author of this position, Loke Umishalem, even though he never said it explicitly, it's implicit in his position. Rav Amar etna nasra Torah vafilu balimo. So Rav comes to fundamentally disagree with applying the principle of Einu Lokei Mishalem over here, because he points out, by the case of Etnan, Etnan is the compensation that is offered to a woman for her services. So that's called Etnan Zonah. And as the Balei Tosafot point out, that Zonah, generally when we speak about Zonah, it means Arayot, means involved in a illicit relationship, but an illicit relationship that is listed amongst the Arayot that someone would end up with a death penalty for or karet for. And so here, the Gemara says, Vafilu Balimo, that it's true, even if the person has an illicit relationship, improper relationship with their mother, and then they give compensation through an animal for those services, that animal cannot end up on the Mizbeach, because it's called Etnan Zonah. It was the compensation, it was the remuneration for the services provided by the Zonah, even though here the Zonah was someone who was totally illegal or illicit to him, meaning that it was subject to arayot. He's going to get a death penalty for engaging with this quote-unquote zonah. Had it been a woman who was single and she provided services to him and he paid for it, then the animal would be at non-zonah, but he wouldn't be subject to any violation that would require a punishment minat Torah. Over here we require a punishment. He's subject to a death penalty over here because of the arayot with his mother. It's a chiyuv karet. And despite that fact, we still say that the payment of the animal turns it into Etnan Zonah. So what that suggests is, and this Rashi lays out here explicitly, there's a long Rashi here explaining this. I've mentioned it before when we did this in Baba Kama. The Ksota Choshen discusses it and also favors this view, the view that Rashi proposes over here. But he says, Alma, from this you would conclude, Afilu b'makom mita nami, Ramu tashlumim alei, that even in a case where there is a death penalty involved, there's still an obligation to pay. Ayala she'ein koach la'ancho b'shtayim. We just don't have the ability or the power to give both punishments. Aval yidei shemaim lo yatza ad sheyishalem. But you're not yotze yidei shemaim until you pay. So that changes the dynamic, which here he is suggesting by the case of Etnan Zonah. Even though we cannot force him to pay the zonah, she really has a legal claim against him because she provided services and he promised to pay. Now, when he doesn't pay, we should be able to take him to court and enforce the payment. The problem is that he's also subject to a death penalty over here, or a chiyuv karet. That precludes us from making the demand for compensation or pursuing the legal claim in court. But what Rashi points out is that doesn't mean that you're exempt. Doesn't mean that you're free of making that payment. The truth is you need to make the payment. We just can't enforce the payment. So that's a big difference. That's what Rav is pointing out. That in these cases, the reason you don't pay is not because you're not chayav to pay. It's because we can't enforce it because of the principle of the Torah, or basically a technicality that the Torah prevents us from enforcing it. Given that, the kaimin deramu tashlumim alei, since he really has an obligation to pay, Lo yatsa yidei chavato ad sheyishalem. You're not done until you pay. Inami, he also quotes from his Rebbeim, itofis lo mafkina minei. If the other person comes and grabs it, we won't take it back from him because, in a sense, he is a rightful owner to this money. He really is owed the money. So again, we will allow the individual to make the payment, or he should make the payment because he is chayav. We can't enforce it in court, or if he takes it into his own hands and takes the payment, we won't interfere because technically he is entitled to that payment. What that means is, or the effect of that is, when he gives the compensation to the zonah, over here it's his mother, that in that case it turns into an etnan zonah because he's really obligated to pay her. Since he's obligated to pay her, when he voluntarily pays her, that converts it or makes it into an etnan zonah, and it's not allowed to be put on the mizbeach, because the compensation was real compensation. Similarly, over here, what Rava is suggesting is, when we say over here, loke umishalem, loke is what definitely happens. The court will give him malkot because he violated a lav. Mishalem doesn't mean the court will enforce the tashlumim. This is what you owe. You owe money, we can't enforce it. And therefore the word here, mishalem, is used differently than it's used in other places where it means that you are obligated. Here it means you should pay, or this is what you are really obligated to pay, but it's not enforceable in court. So that's the way Rashi explains it. Rav Papa Amar, Rav Papa disagrees and says, Mishat Mishicha Ichayev La Bimizonotah. From the moment that he makes a kinyan on the animal, whether he is a shoel, whether he is a socher, whatever his relationship with the animal is vis-a-vis the owners, once he does a kinyan mishicha, he becomes responsible for the animal. That responsibility includes feeding the animal. Milka lolaki achad chasima. The violation of the lav of chasima only happens when he puts it to work while it is muzzled. So they don't happen simultaneously. The only time we cannot obligate you for two items is when they happen through the same action, when they happen simultaneously. Like by the case of the zona, his obligation to pay her, as well as his death penalty, happen at the same time when she provides the service to him. Both of those generate the obligations. So therefore, they're simultaneous, and we can't apply them both. Over here, that's not true. His obligation to feed the animal happened earlier, and then his violation of the law, below tachsom shobidisho, happens at a later point. So then when he withholds food from the animal because he muzzled it, that stems from his original mishicha. That's an obligation that pre-existed the violation of lo tachsom shor b'disho. And therefore what Rav Papa says is, it's a court enforceable payment because they are not simultaneous. They do not preclude each other. And you can be loka mishalim because you're not being loka for the same reason that you are being mishalim. They're shnei shemot. They're totally different reasons by which you're obligated to pay and that you are chayav in malkot. That is Rav Papa's view over here. Now, the Bali at Tosafot deal with what about this word mishalem? Is this word mishalem really a terminology that is used in such situations to say that you are chayav to pay, but we can't enforce that payment? So first of all, he brings a case by Rova that was in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, whereby people had stolen from him through a machteret. They had dug under his house and came to steal. Then they come to voluntarily give back the money that they stole. Rava says you don't have to give it back because kano bedamim. That's what Rav says. Rav says they earned it with their blood. Because when they bava machteret is subject to a death penalty. You can kill someone who comes bava machteret. So when they took the money and they stole by bava machteret, they were really chayav mita at the time. So he's not going to get, it's kimle de rabba mine, whether you say kadei rishato, you can't give them both the death penalty and have them have to pay back the gneva. So when they came and paid it back, Rava refused to take them. Tosafot says, why? Based on our Gemara over here, Rava is saying that even when you're not enforceable in court to pay it, you're still obligated to pay it. So why didn't Rava accept it from them for just the fact that they were obligated to pay him back for the Geneva, even though he couldn't take them to court for it? So Tosafot says something amazing. It says, Yesh lomar, dehem lo ratzu letzeit yidei shemayim, el yusvorim shebedin chayavim lachzir. They didn't think they were being yotzei yidei shemayim. They thought they were obligated under the law to return it to him. And therefore he didn't accept it from them, which is very strange. Why should it matter to Rava what they're thinking? If they're obligated to return it in order to be Yetzeit Yedei Shemayim, even if they're returning it because they think that he has a legal claim against them, either way, they need to return the money, and it's good for them to return the money. Tosafot says here that if you give back the money for the wrong reason, then that's not good. And Rava refused to take it from them because he thought they were giving it back for the wrong reason. That's strange, because then he's preventing them from being Yetzeit Yedei Shemayim. So it's a strange answer. Then he goes on to say, so here Tosafot makes a distinction, which is that the terminology that's used over here, umishalem, that you pay, is a non-enforceable payment. Yeah, when it says in the Gemara, yishalem, he must pay, that's an enforceable payment. So that the language that you use might make a difference. He says, inami, he says another possibility. Now Tosafot takes a different approach, which is also amazing, but he says that once you have to be Yotzei Yidei Shemayim, that becomes a full force obligation. And therefore it uses the term mishalem because you're really obligated, let's say, Yidei Shemayim. So that takes it a step further, which is very hard to understand. He says, well, since you have to be Yotzei Yidei Shemayim, therefore, it's not just do it if you'd like to be Yotzei Yedei Shemayim. You have an obligation to do it. We won't be able to enforce it in court, but it's still an obligation. That let's say Yedei Shemayim, you would have thought is voluntary. You want to be Yotzei Yedei Shemayim, go ahead and do it. Tosafot now upgrades that and says, no, it's not just if you want to do it, you're obligated to do it. We can't enforce it, but you are obligated to do it. There is an obligation for you to do it. It's not voluntary. So that's another step, and that's why he says maybe they use the word mishalem over here, is to indicate the obligation to make the payment, not simply that if you choose to make the payment. If you want to be Yotzei Yedei Shemayim, then you do it. No. You have to be Yotzei Yedei Shemayim, and you have to pay it. We can't enforce it in court, but you need to do this, or you need to make this payment. That's how Tosfot explains the use of the term Mishalem over here. Either one way is to say Mishalem indicates if you want to pay it, versus Yishalem, where you must pay it. He must pay it. Or it's the other version is that once you have to be Yotzei Yedei Shemayim, you must be Mishalem. You are obligated to pay at that point in time. It's not simply if you choose to pay it. That's the two way that Tosfot deals with it. Now, Amar Rava Papa, Hanei Mile Bo Minai Debei Rav Papa Bar Abba. Why this Gemara is brought here is not because it's topically connected, but rather the person who is relating the information is the same person. Rav Papa made the last statement, which is he answered for us why you could be loke umishalem by the case of Chasima. That was Rav Papa gave us the last answer. The Gemara then moves on and says, Amar Rav Papa, Hanei Mile Bo Minai Debei Rav Papa Bar Abba. The Debei Rav Papa Abba asked me these questions. And so it's another memra from Papa. Find that a lot in the Gemara in Brachot. Other places in Shas, it's not as obvious, but it does happen in some places with Agadato. But you'll get a number of memrot from a single Amora. So here you have Rav Papa, you bring a memra that's related. So over here, the relationship is because of Rav Papa, not because the topically that they are connected. So this is not a continuation of that previous statement of Loki Mishalim. So this was asked, this question was posed to Rav Papa, the Beit Midrash of Rav Papa Babu. Pashtiluhu the Isura. And I paskind that it's a sur. Chada kehilchata, chada lav kehilchata. One of them I paskin al pi adin that it was a sur, and that was the locha. In another case, I paskin that it was a sur, even though that wasn't the locha. He was aware that it wasn't the locha, but he felt it was important to paskin that way anyway. Bo minai, they asked of me, mahu lalush et aisha bichalav. Well, is it permissible to knead dough with milk? And I said it's a sur, and that's the halacha that we learned together in Psachim, the Tanya. In lashim et ha'isa b'chalav, one may not knead dough with milk. V'imlash kolapat kula asura. If you do make bread with milk in it, then it is asura. Mipnei hergel abeira, because it's too risky. People assume that bread is pariv. If you don't make it pariv, then they're going to eat it together with meat. They're going to use it with their salami sandwich, their turkey sandwich, and you're going to have now milchik bread together with meat. So that's the problem. So the assumption by all people is that bread is pariv. Therefore, if you make milchik bread, it's a problem because nobody knows that it's milchik bread. And then they're going to make a mistake. Therefore, it's asur to have bread that is milchik. You can't get a shkocha for bread that is milchik unless it has a siman muvhak in it. I mean, that's you dye it blue. You make it in a specific shape that no other breads or no other items are in, so that it's indicative of that. There's one item that is found on the shelves that has that, and that is Thomas English muffins. Thomas English muffins are actually dairy, but they have a very unique shape to them, and it's very clear what they are. Everybody knows what a Thomas English muffin looks like versus just a regular roll piece of bread. And because of that, they have a hechsher that says dairy on it. So it is dairy bread, but it's identifiable. They actually caused the problem a number of years ago when they started to produce pariv English muffins, because that really undermined the idea that it was unique in the sense that it was milchik. Anyway, you're not allowed to have milchik bread. Kiyotsebo. Similarly, in the other direction, meaning that it works in both directions. Bread needs to be pariv. It cannot be milchik, but it also cannot be fleishik. If you make the bread fleishik, then it's also problematic. Ain't tashimet tanur bal ya. You can't baste the oven with fats. V'imtash, if you do such, kolapat kula asura, then the bread that is baked inside of that oven is asura. Ashia sikit at tanur, until you fire through the tanur cycle, where it burns away all the fats. So over here he is basting the walls of the oven with the fats, and then he bakes the bread there. So that is, you know, tain tam. It gives flavor of the fats into the bread. Unless you go through a cycle firing up the oven where it burns away those fats and then it's no longer there and it's not a problem. And she is there enough kaminot. If it's the first time that the oven was used and you do it, then you actually can't get it out of the oven because it then was sealed or hardened with the fats inside of it and therefore becomes a fleishik oven. Here it's talking about a case where it was done after the oven was already used and then you put these fats in it, then you can just burn them off by running a cycle through the oven. So that's number one. Number two is, Tosfot over here says he doesn't even know why you need to fire the oven up. You could simply wipe it away. If you're basting something on the outside, and it's not necessarily absorbed because it wasn't heated, when you put cold items in there, there's no absorption. So why can't you just wipe it away? You could wash it away and wipe it away. He says that would be an easy way to deal with it. I'm sure there's some technical problem here as to why they couldn't wipe it away. It wasn't possible to wipe it away. But so they require you that you heat it up or you burn it away. So So here you can't make fleshig bread also. Meaning that the restriction is both against making milchig bread as well as making fleshig bread because people assume that bread is parik. So they want to be able to put their butter on the bread, but they also want to be able to put their salami on the bread. The only way you can do that is if the bread is parik. And therefore it's a problem to make the bread in a manner that is either milchik or fleshik, and that's what he paskin for them. No milchik bread, and that was kehilchata. Then, v'idach ba'uminai, then the second question that they posed to me was, malachnis min v'she'enu mino l'dir. Are you allowed to put in two species into a single pen or corral? Upashti l'huli sura. I paskin for them that it was asur, talab kehilchata, but that is not the halacha. The halacha is that it's mutar. To put two different animals into a pen or into a corral together. Damar Shmuel, because Shmuel gives us this principle, which is nafkumino both for human beings as well as animals, which is ubimina afim, when it comes to, we'll call it loosely, adulterers, ad shiru kederach hamina afim. You do not need to see them in such detail to be able to testify that they really had relations in order to give them the death penalty, or to make a woman a surah to her husband. What you have to say is that they're acting in a manner that indicates that they're having relations. So you could see them laying together in positions that indicate they're having relations. You don't have to see such detail, the actual act itself, in order to say that they are chayavim. But, ubir kilayim, in order to be chayav for kilayim, ad sheyachnis kemebachol bishpoferet. The farmer, the shepherd, if he is breeding the animals, then you're only chayav for kilayim, which is a mixed breeding. The Torah says you're not allowed to crossbreed when it comes to animals, when you have different species. That crossbreeding is only asur if you physically take the member of the male animal and place it into the female. That you have to be so actively involved. This is a terminology that the Gemara uses in numerous places. It means the actual item is the equivalent of what we have like in a mascara today, where you have a tube in which you dip a brush. And so in their day too, they had these tubes in which they had some powder or some sort of cosmetic or ointment, and then they used to dip a brush or some sort of stick applicator into it in order to apply it. So the same thing here, kemachobish foreret is a euphemistic way to describe the sexual relations. So how much do you need to see of the sexual relations? So here, kimachol b'shpoferet means that's the detail, that's the most explicit description of it. That means that if it was by human beings, you would have to actually see literally the act that was being engaged in, not simply that they're laying together in the method or way that people normally engage. And here by animals, it means that you actively are bringing the male to mate with the female, but not just simply bringing them together, but literally mating them by putting the male member into the female. So here, Shmuel makes a distinction between human beings, where you just have to see kederach hamnafim, versus kilayim, where you have to be actively involved. So now, Rav Papa's psak was, you can't even put them into the corral together. Well, if you can't put them into the corral together, that's nowhere near what Shmuel said. Shmuel said you can only not actively crossbreed them. So then he says, I paskin the Isur, even though that's not the halacha, because the halacha is like Shmuel, and I didn't paskin like them, and Rashi explains over here, shelo yizalzulu, because these people were not so makbin on the halacha, so once I let them put it into the corral together, one thing leads to the next, and then they're makil, so I said, don't put it in the corral, because otherwise one thing leads to the next. So the truth is that there are three different stages that you might be involved with over here. The furthest thing from mating or crossbreeding is putting them together into the corral. The other one is what's called achiza, which is that, say you hold the female in place and allow the male to mount the female. And then the third case is a case here where you actually take the male and mount it onto the female. So Tosafot over here discusses whether Shmuel over here is suggesting there's only an Isur d'Oraita or an Isur d'Rabbanan. From what we see here basically as the Isur d'Oraita is to have you take the male and mount it onto the female. The Isur de Rabbanan would be if you held the female and allowed the male to mount, The case where there's nothing is a case where you allow them to go into a pen or corral together. And that's what Rav Papa is saying. There's not even an Isur Derabanan over here. I still said it was Asur because I didn't want them to be Mezalzel in Isur. But that turns out to be the Halacha. You're allowed to leave animals of different species in a single corral. And even if they're mating, meaning if they go ahead and mate of their own volition, that's not your issue. You do not have to separate them because that's not your obligation. You're only Chayav and Kilayim if you're actually involved in the crossbreeding itself. So Meitiv Rav Chodvai Barami, Ilu Ne'emar, had the Pasuk said, Bechem Techa Lo Tarbiya, so the Pasuk really says, Bechem Techa Lo Tarbiya Kilayim. Had it not written the word Kilayim, I would have thought, Hayiti Omer, Lo Yechoz Adama Beima, B'sha She'ola Aleha Zachar, that you would not be permitted to hold on to the female, or keep the female stationary while the male mounts it. That would be for any animal. Forget about crossbreeding. The reason why, likely, has to do with a Gemara and an Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, "Minishmartem mikol davar ra," that you have to keep yourself away from any bad thing. And lo tatura achrei levavchem v'achrei neichem. Visually seeing something has a very large or disproportionate impact on an individual. That we have the expression, seeing is believing. You can hear about something, but even when you hear about something, when you see it, you're much more likely to believe that it is true. Second of all, if you hear something, it might cause you problems, but when you see something, the trauma caused by seeing it is certainly greater than that of hearing of what happened. Seeing has a disproportionate impact on the individual. The Torah recognizes that and says, "V'nishmarta mikol davar ra," that you have to avert your eyes from things that will cause problems because of your viewing them. One of the things mentioned over there in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is that you should not be watching animals mate. When you watch animals mate, that brings up or drives the Yetzer within an individual, and it leads them to want to have relations or get excited unnecessarily. So a person, Mishrat HaMikol Ra, should not be looking at mating. So that would have been the assumption here. Behem Techa Lo Tarbiya means that you should not be involved in the mating process. That's how I would have read the Pasuk, had it had not had the word Kilayim at the end. But then, once we do have the word Kilayim in the end, it qualifies or modifies the situation and tells us otherwise. So I would have thought you can't hold it. Tamal Omer Kilayim. From Kilayim I learned that you can't then hold on to the Kilayim. But if you look at what we said, the Havamina was, you can't hold the female in order to have the male mount it. Then we say, oh, the word Kilayim comes to teach you that's not true about all animals, it's only true about Kilayim. But what does that improve? What does that say? La Michlau, de Kilayim Achiza Nami, lo. What you would learn from that is that holding the female in place would have been restricted. But Papa just said before in the name of Shmuel, the only restriction is if you actually mount the male onto the female. But holding the female in place is not problematic. From this brayta, it makes it sound like you would have thought holding the female is problematic for all animals. Kilayim teaches you not for all animals, only for crossbreeds. But that means in crossbreeds, the problem is if you holding the female stationary while the male mounts, not you mounting the male on the female. So that goes against Shmuel's position. Where it says, my achiza, what is achiza over here? Achnasa. It means literally mounting the male into the female. Vamai kari le achiza. So then why does it call it achiza if it's called, if it is achnasa? Lishna ma'alya. It's a euphemistic term. The bride, they didn't want to say achnasa. They didn't want to be so explicit about what you're doing here. But it's terming achnasa, which is you taking the male and mounting it on the female in terms of achiza, of holding it in place. So holding it in place, you thought it meant to hold the female in place. No, achiza means you're putting the male, you're holding the male member and putting it into place. So now a similar question, which is Amar Rav Yehuda. Min b'mino mutar lachnis kimemachol b'shfoferet. When it comes to a similar breed, then you're allowed to, a similar species, you're allowed to then mount the male onto the female. V'afilu mishum pritzut aleka. And you don't have this problem of the Gemara in Avodah Zarah that says, v'nishmarta mikol davara, that you lo yistakel b'chamor b'chamora, b'chazir b'chazira, b'sha shem z'vgim, that you're not allowed to watch animals mate. Over here, we're allowing you to actively mate the animals. Why is that okay? My taimo is a very big het there, which is ba'avidtei tarid. He's involved in his professional duties. He's doing this not to enjoy, kick back, and watch what's happening. He's actively involved in the process because this is his job. He's doing his job. He's doing his work. He's trying to get them to crossbreed. You don't have time to be mehar here in these situations because you're actively involved in your work. This, Babadatei Tarid, is used in sometimes in professional settings to allow for male-female interactions like doctors or these situations of mating, because babadite tarid, because you're involved in your professional services, there's no time to get excited or to have the wrong thoughts in those situations. So that's the concept of babadite tarid, which avoids the problem. So the same question that we proposed before is, you're not allowed to hold the female steady while the male mounts it. That's only kilayim that's asur. Ha min bimino shori. That by mimino it's mutar. Umin bimino nami achiza in achnasalo. And even by min bimino, it is achiza that you're allowed to do. But achnasa lo. But the active mating, meaning that you mounting the male onto the female, that would be problematic. So again here, the Gemara gives the same answer gave before. My achiza achnasa. Achiza over here is a euphemistic term for achnasa. My kari le achiza lishna ma'alya. The reason it used the term achnasa instead of achiza is because it's euphemistic, and truthfully it doesn't mean holding the female. Achiza here means holding the male and putting the male or mounting the male into the female. So interesting here is that the Gemara asked an identical question, the same question it asked in the previous case it asked over here. It seems that maybe the question is either asked once, and when they put the Gemara together, they had it asked on both situations because the question was relevant for both situations. Or the Gemara thought that maybe it would be different over here somehow, and therefore it asked the question again. But it does seem strange that the Gemara gave the same question twice and gives the exact same answer in both cases, that Amravashi, Hamilta Boiminai Debe Rab Nechemia Reish Kaluta. So Ravashi says this issue was brought before me by the Beit Midrash, whether it's Rab Nechemia or Ravana, of the Reish Kaluta, meaning that they were associated with the exilarch. Is it permissible to put into the same corral two of the same species and one of a different species? Do we say since he has someone of his own species in there, he's going to be driven after his own species? Maybe over here, even so, it should not be. I said it's a sur, even though that's not the halacha. Here, Rav Ashi is saying that he did something similar to Rav Papa. He says, I know that this is not the halacha, but on an extrajudicial basis, I'm saying it's a sur because Mishum Pritzutza de Avde. This is a refrain that the Gemara has in many places, which is the Avadim of the Reish Kaluta were very difficult individuals. They were servants of the exilarch. Therefore, they carried power, transferred out of power because they worked for the exilarch and they were in the exilarch's house. On the other hand, they were Avadim. And since they were Avadim, they weren't necessarily the finest of character or choicest of people. And therefore, they didn't follow Allah or they did things incorrectly or improperly. So, the Achramim, we see this many places in Shas, used to give Sak Piske Alocha of the exilarch or the exilarch's house that weren't necessarily La Alocha in order to rein in these Avadim who were freewheeling and doing what they pleased because of the fact that they were part of the exilarch's house. So Rav Ashi is indicating that was the case here. He didn't allow them to put it all into one corral, even though they were one of its own species and a different species. And there you could argue, even more so it's not problematic. We said before that even if you put two different species in the corral, it's fine. Over here you have its own species and other species, it certainly should be fine. Nevertheless, he passed in the Isur because he was afraid of the behavior of these Avadim, that they'd go in there after you put it in, they'd go and say, oh yeah, it mated by itself, but they would be encouraging or helping the mating process go on, and therefore he passed in the Isura. So now, next Mishnah, Hayeh Osebi Yadav of Lo Biraglav. If the poel or the animal is working with its hands, not its legs, Biraglav Lo Biyadav, he's working with his legs and not his hands, Afilo Biktefo. It's more likely to be by a poel, because you're separating between Yadav and Raglav, but remember now, we've already established that the din is the same for a poel who is entitled to eat as a shor that is able to eat. Right. So the din will be equally applicable to both of them. What is engaged in avodah mean over here? So that you're allowed to eat. What entitles you to eat? So here we had yadav without raglav, raglav without yadav, or ktefo. Ktefo is neither yadav nor raglav. He's carrying on his back. Harizel chel. All of these entitled you to eat. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yudah Omer, Achi Yaseh Biyadav Raglav. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yudah believes that you have to be engaged both with your feet and your hands. My taima. What is the reason? Ki tavo bikerem reyacha b'chol maidovit. The reason for the Tanakama is that the pasuk begins when you come into the vineyard of your friend. After that, it does not define the work that you're engaged in. That means whatever work you're engaged in, once you're brought into the kerem, the vineyard of your friend, that will entitle you to eat. So there is no limitation. There is no qualification. Only hands, only feet. That's not there. All it says is you come in. Once you come in, then you're chayav to feed him. My time, the Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda? Kishor. Because it says, look, tachsom, shor bidisho. Mashor, achi asebi adav raglav. The working of a shore, by definition, is with its hands and its feet, because it's on all four. And so, where it's threshing, it's using all four parts in order to engage. Af poel, because of the hekesh between the shore and the poel, achi asebi adav viraglav. Similarly, until he does with his hands and his feet, he will not be obligated. Boy, rabba baravuna, dash babazim, the tanu golim. What happens if he uses birds to do the threshing? He uses geese or he uses chickens. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, mahu. According to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, what's the din? B'chol kochol be'inan va'ika. You just need them to be engaged with all of their strength, all of their power, and they are. So for a human being, that would require both hands and legs. For an animal, it would require all four. But for animals like these birds that only have two to work with, then all their koach is with their feet, with their 2 feet that they have. Odilma. B'yadav roglav be'inan va'aleka. Or is there a strict requirement that you need yadayim raglayim? The birds have yadayim, but they're called wings. And so maybe they'd have to be engaged with their wings as well, which won't happen. And therefore, it's not classified as a problem. Teiku, we live this as an unresolved issue. So now the Balei Tosafot deal with over here, didn't we say before in the Gemara that the word shor, when we say lo taksom shor b'disho, is not particular to shor. Shor means any animal. That's what we said before, like shor, shor, mi shabbat. And the din by Shabbat is that the word shor is included. Behema chayan of are all included under the term shor. That means over here, it would be true as well. The word shor would include behema chayan of. That means Rabbi Yehuda has to agree that of is also included. So then what's the question of the Gemara at all? So what you have to say is, the machloke between Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim or the Tanakama is, the Tanakama and the Chachamim believe that shor is not meaningful in the context at all. Shor is just a mechanism or a vehicle to bring all animals in. Once you bring all animals, each animal, according to its way, will be chayav. That's the view of the Chachamim. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda views the word shor as bringing all animals in, but shor also gives definition to the halacha. Just like you have by nezikin, the shor is an example. So every animal is chayav, but the shor sets down the principles or the guidelines by which we are mechayev people by nezikin. So to over here, the shor is bringing in behema chayanov, but then it defines what is considered to be melacha that entitles it to eat, because shor is the paradigm. And since it's the paradigm, it influences the definition of the melacha over here. And it'll affect the birds. Even though the birds are included through shor, it still will define for them what is melacha. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Ravua, Po'alim ad shlo yilchu sheti ve'erev begat, uchlim anavim ve'in shultim yayin. The workers that are hired to press the grapes, they press the grapes by walking on the grapes. They stomp on the grapes in order to press them. So these po'alim, before they've walked in a crisscross across the gat to press the grapes, until that point in time, their only entitlement is to eat grapes. Because they're working with grapes, therefore they can eat grapes. What they can't do is be working with grapes and drinking wine. So they must have created some sort of juice already before they can engage in drinking juice. So he says, at minimum, they have to have done a crisscross of walking in the gat, because then there's already juice in the gat, and that entitles them now to drink juice along with the grapes. Vein shodim yayin. Mishael chu sheti be'erev begat, once they've done the crisscross in the press, ochlim avneim v'shonim yayin, then they're entitled to both eat the grapes and drink the wine, meaning that now you have engaged in the malacha in both items, and therefore you are now entitled to eat from both items. Okay, now the next Mishnah takes this last piece of the Gemara, really, and then moves into more detail about that. Hayal sebeteinim lo yuchal ba'anavim. If he's working with the figs, he can't be eating the grapes. So say he's working with the figs and behind him is a vineyard. He can't be picking grapes and eating them while he's working with the figs. Banavim lo yuchal b'tainim. And same and vice versa. Which is that if he's working with the grapes, he can't be eating figs. Aval. What he is entitled to do is moneh atzmo ad shemagia l'makom yafot v'ochel. He can hold back from eating until he gets to the parts of the vines that have the best grapes, and then he can eat them. Or he gets to the part of the tree that has the best figs and eats them. He's not compelled to eat as soon as he gets there. He can choose when he wants to eat. And he can eat more from one section than he eats from another section. He doesn't have to eat evenly either. He has a right to eat whenever he feels like eating, as long as he's engaged in the work. Your entitlement is only while you're engaged in the work. That's what we saw before here with regards to the pressing, that it's only when you're engaged in the work that you are allowed to eat. So if you are engaged in making juice, you can drink juice. If you have yet to be engaged with the juice, you're just engaged with the grapes, you can only eat the grapes, not drink the juice. But for the benefit of the owners, meaning Hashavat HaVeda, giving them back lost time, we give them the right to eat when they move from row to row. If they are moving from row to row, technically they're not engaged in the work. Since they're not engaged in the work, they should not be able to eat during that period of time. But what we do is we give them special permission to eat at that time because of the fact that the balim will lose out. If they have to eat when they get to the next location, then they're going to stop working or they're going to not engage as much. This way, if they eat in between, it will give him more time on the job. They're more productive in that case. So they did this for the benefit of the owners. U'b'chazirata min agat. And when they come back from the gat, u'b'chamor shi poreket. So here it seems to be additional cases like this. Chozeret min agat means that they're coming back from the press. So he allows them to eat as they're moving around from press to press, or they're coming back from the press, because again, it's to his benefit. Even though they're not entitled halachically to eat because they're not engaged in the work, if he allows them to eat during that period of time, then they'll do more work or be more productive when they're actually working. And then, bechamor shi poreket. And similar to a donkey when it's being unloaded. So that we have to understand. The Gemara at the end of today's daf will explain that. Ibailu. So now the question is, ose begefen zeh, mao shi ochal begefen acher. You're working on this particular vine. Can you pick grapes from the next vine over? Mimin sha'ata noten lekelav shel balabayit be'inan. Though what you're putting into the baskets of the balabayit is required, va'ika. You're putting grapes in, and you're eating grapes, so that's totally fine. O dilma mima sha'ata noten lekelav shel balabayit be'inan va'aleka. Or is it that exactly what you're putting into the basket of the balabayit is what you're entitled to eat? It's not about the mean, it's exactly what you're putting in. From this vine, you can eat from this vine. You go to the next vine, you can eat from that vine. But you can't put from this vine and eat from the next vine. If you say that you're not allowed to eat from the next vine, shor b'mechubar heichi ochel. Where is a scenario where a shor is working with mechubar? Mechubar, we know, is only at the gemar melacha. It means that when you are harvesting, when you are completing the process. So the shor who is engaged in this process, how does he ever eat? So the way Rashi phrases the question, Rashi says that they used to bring shfarim into the vineyards, pulling a wagon. And so then the pickers would put the grapes from the vine into the wagon. But the way that the shor is hitched up, that means that he's in front of the wagon. There's no way that he's going to be eating from the vine that they're picking from. Because they're picking onto the wagon that's hitched to him, and he's in front of that wagon. So he's looking at some other vine and eating from some other vine. So how could you have a scenario like that? The Bali and Tosafot are not so happy with that explanation of Rashi, because he says, Vein nira l'ri, dao gefen abitalush, v'lo mechubar. He says that gefen was already detached and not attached. V'hachi perusho b'mechubar. Hainu k'shehu dash b'mechubar. Tosafot says the case when he's threshing b'mechubar. Heche mishpacha la shiuchal otan shibalim atzmam shu dash. He is stepping on certain things, but his mouth is in front of what he's stepping on. So he's eating stuff that is not necessarily what he is threshing or what he's stepping on. So now, if he is dash threshing while it's still attached to the ground, then when he steps on a stalk, the stalk that he steps on is not the stalk that he's eating, because he's eating stuff that is in front of him. I mean, I think Tosafot's case seems to be more far-fetched, that he's threshing while the items are still attached to the ground. That's very hard to argue. And then the Gemara's question is, how could it be that he is threshing and eating at the same time? Either way, the question now makes it that from the shor, the fact that a shor be mechubar has an entitlement to eat, makes it sound like you must have a right to eat from a different item than you're particularly working with. I'm Rav Shisha Brei, the Rav Ide Beshircha, or Beshidcha. Either one of the words, it means something that is very long. According to Rashi, it's a vine that is a very long vine. So even though they're picking from one end of the vine, they sure could be eating from the other end of the vine. And therefore, he's still on one gefen. Or in the case in the field where he's threshing, he's stomping, he's standing on these items, they're very long. So when he stands on the item, it moves towards his mouth and he's able to eat the same one that he is standing on because it's long. So therefore, you can't prove anything from the case of Shor b'Mechubar that does not upend or undermine the possibility that you may only partake of the tree or the vine or the particular item that you are working from. Tashma, Hayose b'Teinim lo yuchal b'Anavim. Our Mishnah says that if he's working with figs, he may not eat grapes. Ha'Teinim v'Teinim, Dumya d'Teinim v'Avanim ochel. But that implies that if it was from something of a similar nature, which is that if it was a case of figs and figs, similar to figs and grapes, by definition, figs and grapes are on separate items because one's growing on a tree, one's growing on a vine. So by definition, they're separate. So that would imply from our Mishnah that it's only when it's two different species may you not eat from it. But if it was the same species, then you would be permitted to eat from it, even though it's a separate tree over here. It's a separate fig tree. So lo yuchal b'ani ha'teinim v'teinim, dumi ha'teinim v'avanim ochel. If you say to me, if he's working on one vine, he may not eat from the other vine, then where's the case where you're able to eat from Teinim and Teinim, similar to Teinim and Anavim? I'm Rav Shisha Brei de Ravidi. So again, Rav Shisha Brei de Ravidi comes to the rescue again and says, Bimodlit. It's a case where they are laying on top of each other. So in the case where you have, for instance, a grapevine that's hanging on the fig tree, so now you're working with the figs. You would think maybe I can eat the grapes because I have to move the grapes to get to the figs. So I'm quote unquote working with the grapes. The answer is no, you may not do that because over there they're separate entities. But that means in a case where you have grapes and grapes, you have two vines that are intertwined, or by fig trees we have two trees that are intertwined, there you could say that when you move up the grapes from one, you can eat from the other in that case because they're, in essence, considered to be one vine now, or connected because you're in the same species. And therefore, it's not just separating species. Here, you would pick from both vines. And that gives you permission to eat from one vine, even though you're working on the other vine when they're mixed together. And same thing with the fig. You can eat from one fig tree as the other fig tree is intertwined in what you're trying to work with. Tashma. The end of our Mishnah says that you're allowed to hold on to your appetite until you get to the place with the best grapes or the best figs. Vochel, and then you can eat. If you tell me that if you work on this vine, you're allowed to go to another vine, let him go up to the best place, pick them, come back to where he's working, and then while he's working, he'll eat those ones that he picked before. Where it says, that doesn't work. He doesn't have a right to eat if it causes him to be unproductive. He can't walk away from his work. Go pick the grapes from someone else and come back and work on this vine, because that means that he's walking away from his work. He has an obligation to be engaged in his work when he's eating. That's one of the principles of the poel and the shore eating, is that they have to be engaged in their work when they are eating. So the Gemara says, it's a case where he desists or he's unproductive, that we don't ask the question about. When his wife and children are there with him, they are not hired, they are not working with him, but they can go and pick for him from the other item. So now there's no bito malacha. They go bring the grapes to him from the other vine, the best, and he would eat them. Tashma, from here you would think, so over there, all the cases there, we said that when you're engaged in the work, you're entitled to eat. But because of the benefit to the balim, we say, we allow them to eat when they're moving from row to row within the vineyard. Or when they're returning from the gat, or moving from press to press. Walking is the equivalent of being engaged in the activity or the melacha of the balabait. Because when you walk from row to row, the reason you're walking to the next vine is to do the work of the balabait. So you're engaged in his work. The only reason we allow you to eat here is because of a takanah derabanan, because it's to the benefit of the balim. Midoraita lo achil. But mina Torah, you would not be entitled to eat, even though you're engaged in the work of the balabait. Why? Alma also begeven ze, einu achel begeven acher. Because you're taking grapes from the previous vine that you're working on, and you're walking towards the new vine. That means you're eating grapes from the previous vine, and engaged in work for the new vine, because your walking is leading you to the next vine. So what do you see from here? That midoraita, that would not be allowed. You would not be allowed to eat in that case. It's only because of the takana, the rabbanan, that you're allowed to eat. So that seems to prove our point, that if you're engaged with one vine, you may not eat from the other vine. The Gemara says, No. It's true. If you're working on this vine, you can eat from the other vine. What's the failure here? When you're walking from one road to the next, you're not in work. You're not working for the balabait anymore. You're not engaged in work. You can't eat. So therefore, the reason you need a dispensation, midi rabbanan, is because you're not engaged in work. Ikadamre, so there's another version of this that does it just in the opposite direction. Savrua, they thought, malech lav kosem asadami. When you're walking from road to road, that's not considered to be engaged in the work of the balabait. That's why mina Torah, you can't eat it. Mishum de lav kosem asadami, because you're not engaged in the work of the balabait. Ha osemase, were you in to be engaged with the work of the balabait? Achil midoraita, you'd be entitled to eat one vine to the next, even midoraita. Alma oseh begeven zeochel begeven acher. So from this you would conclude that if you're working on one vine, you're entitled to eat from another vine, because you're still engaged in work. No, the Gemara says, lo, lo mei melecha oseh begeven ze, eno ochel begeven acher. No, the right conclusion here is that if you're working on this vine, you may not work on the other vine. Umaleich kosem asedomi. But that walking is as if you're engaged in the melacha of the balabait, and that's why you're not entitled to eat when you walk from one to the next midoraita, because it's eating from one vine while you're going to engage in work in another vine. So it's exact same Gemara, just in reverse as to what is the Avamina. Ubachamor shi poreket. So a chamor, when it's being unloaded. Shi poreket meichan achla. If you've unloaded the donkey already, what is it eating anymore? The donkey is only allowed to eat while it's engaged in the work. The work is hauling the load. If you've unloaded the donkey already and everything's off its back, it doesn't have a right to eat anymore because it's no longer hauling the load. The load is off its back. So Gemara says, Ema ad shetehei poreket. It's allowed to eat until it is unloaded. You can read it that way. Or the way that Rashi reads it is, that while it is walking, it unloads itself. That's how you would say it. That it's allowed to unload itself. Ad shetehei poreket. If it's unloading itself, it's fine because it's eating from its back. That's unloading itself. A donkey and a camel can eat, turn their heads, and eat from that load which is on them. But you're not allowed to do is take from the load and feed it to them. They can, if they can reach it themselves and eat it themselves, they're entitled. But you can't actually facilitate their eating of the load. And so that's the braita that we're bringing to support this understanding of our Mishnah. So tell us what it says over here. The Avamina was that you would only be allowed to eat when you see something in front of you. Even though we already determined that it's not because of the tsar that you allow him to eat, but rather because it's beneficial to the animal to eat. That's why he eats. Nevertheless, the Avamina here would have been that only when the food is in front of it, there's an entitlement to eat it. When it's behind it, maybe he wouldn't be entitled. So that's the Kamashman of the Gemara, that even when it's behind it, if he's hauling it, then he has a right to eat it, but that's as long as he is hauling it. Kamash Milan, that what Tosfot says is that the Bnei Hasheva Veda does not modify the Hi Poreket. The Chamor Shi Poreket is not a part of the other items that were listed here. It listed moving from row to row, moving from vat to vat, or from press to press, and then it said Chamor Shi Poreket. You would have thought that's also under this rubric of Hasheva Veda. The answer is no. That's an independent statement at the end of the Mishnah, that the chamor eats from its back, not because of Hasheva Veda, but Me'ikar Adin. It has a right to eat from its back, because the requirement is not that it sees it in front of it, but simply be engaged in the malacha. Okay, we'll stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Tzadi Bet Amud Aleph.